Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I'm an alcoholic and certainly powerless over cocaine. The grace of God separated me from drugs in, what was it? I think it was sometime in March 1989. I relapsed on alcohol and finally ended up struggling myself sober. And I claim a sobriety date of and clean date of December 28th, 1989. I'm very, very grateful for where my life has gone because of the 12 steps. I really am a supporter of Cocaine Anonymous because it has found very, very important the recovery process that I was exposed to and that was instrumental in my own personal recovery. I'm thinking back about my using experience. The first time I started to use was bizarrely enough when I was about 6 years old. I had discovered a 5 gallon army jerry can of gasoline in the basement that my father would use. It was unleaded gasoline, special gasoline for the lawnmower, and it was in an old army jerry can. And I remember opening up the lid and huffing it. Nobody showed me how to do this. It's just something that I figured out myself because I liked the smell of this gasoline. And I found that if I breathed the fumes, it would change the way I felt. And here I am, 6 years old, and I would go downstairs and I would huff the gasoline. I remember this one time I came upstairs and I was like staggering around. And my parents were just like laughing, thinking I was just being a crazy kid. I was stoned out of my mind. One day, now, the grace of God has been operative in my life many, many times. Seconds and inches have come between me and death 1,000 times. And I'm sure I'm not the only person in here. I should have OD'd. I should have been killed. So many times it's unbelievable. But what happened was, I was huffing this stuff to the point where it was gonna probably affect me permanently. And I can remember a feeling and a thought coming over me saying, "You can't do this anymore." And this thought came from outside of myself. And I've heard many, many people talk about hearing voices or getting messages or being guided during that moment of clarity prior to finding a way into sobriety. And this event happened to me when I was 6 years old. And between 6 and about 13, I remained pretty much abstinent. And when I was 13, I discovered Boone's Farm apple wine, and very quickly thereafter, LSD prescription pills and Quaaludes. Anybody remember Quaaludes? They were great. Oh man, I remember the great Quaalude epidemic in Ridge High School in Basking Ridge, 1972. What happened was my buddy had an older brother, and the older brother was a drug dealer. And one night he came home at about 10 o'clock and took this big, huge bag of Roar 714 Quaaludes and put them down on this guy's desk and said, "Sell those at school tomorrow." So the guy goes, "Okay." He comes into school the next day. It's about 7:30. We're at the smoking area behind the school. We're all sitting around, you'd shoot the shit and have a cigarette. And he brought out this big bag of those, they're like green Quaaludes, and put them down. And we're all like, "What are those?" "Those are Quaaludes. Nobody had ever heard of them before." "How much are they?" "Oh, they're $1 a piece." "How many do you take?" Now, he didn't know because he'd never done it before. So he goes, "I don't know, 3 or 4. So about 50 of us did 3 or 4 Quaaludes before first period in high school. I got to tell you, that caused some consternation at the Board of Ed. The ambulance was back and forth all day long with people, you know, falling on their face. And, it was just, we just thought it was cool, you know, this kind of behavior. I remember the same guy bringing in a big bag of belladonna. Now, I'm really hoping nobody in here has experience doing belladonna, because it's insane to do anything with it, because it's a poisonous weed. But this guy brought it all in, and you crush it up into like tea. And I remember doing enough of it that I went blind for a period of time. I mean, it affected my vision. And it was like a hallucinogenic weed that makes you go blind. And a whole bunch of us had the same problem. We all show up in school the next morning going, "Hey, did you go blind too?" You know, because our sight came back to us overnight. And, you know, then there was the times where they were passing around LSD. LSD was probably easier to get than beer for me in high school. I can't even tell you some. Here's one LSD story. I lived about an hour outside of New York City, so we would go in and we would see concerts, like practically every weekend. We would go see one of those awesome 1970s rock and roll bands. I remember we were at a concert, I think it was Foghat and Wishbone Ash, and when you'd go into the bathroom and you'd buy your drugs, you know, and so we're in the bathroom and we're half drunked up, but we're like seeing what we could buy. And I remember we bought a bunch of LSD and we ate it. And 10 minutes later, we're not high, so we're like, "We got ripped off! Let's go back!" And we go back in and we're looking for the people who ripped us off. They're gone, but there's new people selling LSD. So we buy more. We eat that. And we're still not high like a half an hour later, so we go back and we buy more. And meanwhile, the concert's almost over. By the time we're walking out of that place, we're in Disneyland in 3D. You know, it's just whoa. And we make it down to the van, and about 10 of us pile into the van, and we start heading back to Jersey, going back home. And if anybody's familiar with the Lincoln Tunnel, you know how there's like a bunch of lanes, and they go, you know, like 10 lanes, 8 lanes, 6 lanes, down to 2 lanes, and you go into the tunnel. Well, as we're heading for the tunnel, one of the guys toward the front of the van said, "Hey, man, we'll never fit." And we move forward, okay? We move forward in the van, and we're all now looking, and we're going, "He's right! He's right! It's a mouse hole!" So it took us 45 minutes, but we backed out of there. Backed out of there and took the bridge. Oh, man. Now, cocaine. I started my heavy partying, you know, around 1970, 1971. That's how old I am. And back then, cocaine was very expensive and not really easy to get. In my early days, I'm talking about in my high school days. I remember you would buy little tiny bags for about $20, and it would barely be enough cocaine to get you high. It was just not the right kind of drug for the people that I was hanging out with. And because for $20 in 1971 or 72, you better be able to get high for a week on $20. You could buy 4 finger bags of pot for $20. You know, you could buy gallons of whiskey for $20. You could buy 20 Quaaludes for $20. You could get a bunch of stuff. And the cocaine was it was maybe like a tenth of a gram or something. It wasn't much for $20. So not a lot of us were doing it. But as I was getting older, I went to Florida to go to college. Now, that's a whole different story down in Florida. We had connections in the Miami area. I was living in Tampa, and we would do runs down to Miami. And you could get grams for like $20 and $30. Now, that changed the whole landscape as far as cocaine consumption went with me. Now, I'm a heavy-duty alcoholic. So what happens with cocaine is, my normal drinking looks like this. I'll buy some hard liquor, I'll start drinking it, and within an hour and a half, I'm drunk. Within 2 hours, I'm in a blackout. Within 3 hours, I'm passed out. That's how aggressive my alcoholism is. Now, every time. Now, If you drink like that, it's going to cut down on your social life a little bit, okay? Because you're going to go out with your friends and you're going to end up passed out, you know, halfway through their party. So guess what? Guess what I discover? I discover that cocaine will allow me to continue to drink without getting tongue-chewing, blithering, passed out drunk. I'll be there, but you know, I'll be awake and kind of cognizant while I'm doing it. So there was many nights I spent hundreds of dollars, you know, on stuff to get me down and stuff to bring me up, and mixing them together. You know, like, because cocaine's kind of a stimulant and alcohol is kind of a depressant. So mixing those two is insane, but I spent a whole lot of time doing that. Now, crack was just coming around toward the end of my using. We're talking about the mid to late 80s. And I remember I would be going into, if I was going for cocaine, I was going into Harlem. The better connections were in there. If I was going for heroin, I would go into Brooklyn. The better connections were in there. But in both these places, you could get the little vials of crack. And I would do that when I could. The end of my cocaine use, this is basically what happened. This is New Year's, 1988-1989. I had some good connections. I knew a lot of people, and some guys asked me, "Would you get us a quarter ounce of cocaine for our party on New Year's?" And I said, "Sure, I'd be happy to do that." And I get the quarter ounce, and I call them up, and I say, "I got your quarter ounce." Or, you know, in secret language, and they go, "Well, we don't really need it now. We got it somewhere else, but, you know, thanks. Appreciate the effort." And they don't even really invite me to their party. So I'm sitting at home, and I think I'll just have a line, you know, right? Does that make sense? And after you have one line, what do you do next? You have another line. And you know, I'm just going to have one more. Well, needless to say, for 3 days straight, until it was gone, I was doing lines. Now, that's the phenomenon of craving. That's the physical allergy that they talk about in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. No matter how much is in your body, it creates a craving for more. And certainly cocaine is like that with me. The more you have in you, the more you want. Now, you know, work is coming up. I mean, my vacation is over and work is coming up. I've got to be at work at 8 o'clock in the morning. And 7 o'clock in the morning, I'll just do one more line and I'll get a half an hour of sleep. I mean, it's insane. And during all this, I really went psychotic. Has anybody in here ever had, like, cocaine psychosis? You've done so much of it that you've just lost touch with the reality. Well, what happened with me was I became convinced there was a piece of scotch tape stuck on the roof of my mouth. Okay? And I couldn't get this sumbitch and thing off. And I took a knife and I ground the skin off of the top of the roof of my mouth trying to get this scotch tape off. You know, convinced that there's somebody put scotch tape on the top of my mouth. And I scraped all the meat off right down to the bone. You know, it was really unbelievable. Anybody experience paranoia on cocaine? You know, they're going to get you. You know, the crazy thing is who would waste overtime on a task force to look for you? You know what I mean? Like, please. Do you know how much it costs to stake people out? And they're going to stake you out? I don't think so. You know? But it's like, you know, peering. I was in this one meeting one time. And somebody is sharing about their cocaine usage. And they're talking about getting down on the floor and in the carpet. You know, looking for the cocaine that might have dropped in the carpet. Has anybody ever done that before? Well, this guy is discussing and he's going, yeah, I would look for the carpet. And somebody from the back of the room goes, crumbin! You know, there's like a name for it. I thought that was hysterical, you know. So yes, I've crumbed, you know. Unbelievable. Now my life during the '80s is like a lost decade to me. I mean, in the '70s, my drinking and my drug use, at least something was working. I was out there with my buddies. I was having fun. Yeah, I was crashing cars and ending up in jail, not knowing why I'm there. But that wasn't really too high of a price to pay because I was living it large in the 70s. But what happened was I crossed a line somewhere around 1980 into unbelievably just vindictive using. Like, I don't care what it was, I would overdo it. If it was alcohol, I'd be in a blackout, passed out in 3 hours. If it was cocaine, I'd do it until it was gone. Didn't matter how many days I was up. There was a time when I was doing the script thing with all the doctors, and I had Xanax prescriptions. Anybody ever do Xanax in here? I got to the point where I didn't even count them anymore. I weighed them. I would, you know, that's enough, and you know, take about 40, and then drink half a quart of vodka, you know, and just be limber, you know, not be able to go from one side of the room to the other without breaking furniture. It was a nightly thing, you know, like unbelievable. I heard a guy say this one time, and I so identify with it, you know, because I would do it. I'd be at the school or something, or somebody have some pills, and you know, I'd snatch a pill out of their hand, eat it, and then say, "What was that? By the way, you know, which way am I going to go, up or down? You know, could have been a dog worming pill. You know, I saw a pill and I ate it. You know, could have been a birth control pill And you know, I want it out of me. Now here's the thing. I have a new job at the beginning of the year. In November, I took a new job. But before that, I had a media job. And this media job was interviewing the top people in addiction treatment. The people who run the rehabs, the people that write the DSM medical textbooks. I mean, I am telling you, the absolute top people in addictions, and it was my job to interview them, get to know them, spend some time with them, go around to all the symposiums, you know, where all the cutting edge addictionology knowledge is going. And I spent about 3.5 years doing this, and there's some things that they just don't, most of them just don't understand. Like, why? What is wrong with you? What is wrong with you? Why do you have to use mountains of drugs? Gallons and gallons, you know, swimming pools filled with bourbon. Why do we need to do that? What is wrong with us? Now think about this. Whatever your drug of no choice is, whether it's alcohol, whether it's cocaine, whether it's crack, whether it's speed, you know, whether it's heroin. Think about this. When you were going to get it, you weren't right. And you were going to get it to get right. Now, I'll give you an example from my experience. Okay, I would be coming home from work. I was an electrician in the 80s. I was working in construction, and I'd get off at 4:30 every day, and I'd jump in my car and I'd head for the liquor store and then head home. You know, I had a mission, and God help you if you were doing 35 and it was a 45 mile an hour zone, and you were slowing me down from getting to the liquor store. You were ditch food. I mean, you know. And then I'd get into the liquor store and I'd grab my bottle. It was usually Gordon's vodka or George Dickel bourbon. One or the other. So, you know, I would drink the bourbon until I couldn't drink it anymore, and I'd go to the vodka. And I'd drink the vodka until I couldn't drink it anymore and go back to the bourbon. But anyway, I'd have a bottle of one of these things, and I'd head for the cashier. And if there was somebody in the way, somebody like some woman like talking about wine, you know, what kind of wine will go good with, you know, the smoked trout, you know, I think a blush red, get out of my way, will you? I got something to do, okay? And then she pulls out a check, you know, starts writing a check, and, you know, talking, is Harry still in the hospital? Oh yeah, Harry's. I don't care about Harry. Get out of my way. You know? Don't you know? I got a problem here. I'm sober. Get out of my way. You know? I mean, do you understand what I'm saying? Now, doesn't that lead you to believe that the problem isn't really the drug? Or the booze. The problem is your spiritual or emotional condition. Why am I sitting there like, I got to get home and start to drink? Why am I like this? What is wrong with me? You know, now, when you're involved really heavily with the drugs, or when you're involved really heavily with the alcohol, you can't see truth from false. You can't look. And you cannot accurately assess how much trouble you're in or what your problem is. You're going to minimize. You're going to say, yeah, you know, I do a little bit of cocaine, but. Or, yeah, you know, I drink a little bit, but. The real problem is your spiritual condition. Most normal people can be sober and clean without it causing any anxiety. Without it making them, you know, without becoming uncomfortable at any level, they do not need to medicate themselves to get right. So there's something wrong with us. And in 1935 through 39, the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous was really the Oxford group. They figured it out. And they started to understand that it's a spiritual condition. That's what our problem is. If we were spiritually fine, we would be able to take or leave anything. We'd be able to moderate or stop altogether, no problem. Now, I know that the drugs were causing me a big problem. I signed myself into rehab. Okay, to get away from booze and drugs. The rehab stint worked on the drugs. It did not work on the booze. I relapsed. It's Christmas, 1989, at the Schroeder household. Okay, I'm living with my mother because that's what you do when you're in your mid-30s. You know, and you've burned every bridge and lost every job and spent every dime. You know, that's what you do. You wherever you are, you figure that mom needs some help around the house, and you go back. And I'm living at mom's, and my sister and brother come in, nieces and nephews. You know, cats. Everybody, they all come in for Christmas, 1989, and I get a resentment. I start to get mad because somebody said something. You know what I mean? Somebody said something. And I go off, and I go into a violent, and this is all in a blackout, I go into a violent flip out, and I threaten my entire family with a .38 caliber handgun. I'm going to kill all of you, all right? That's not the festive mood that they were all looking for, I've got to tell you. They packed up, and they took their Christmas elsewhere. Which is probably a very sane and sound thing to do. I come to after a 3-day blackout, and I am absolutely shattered. Absolutely shattered. And I know that there's one place left. I need to go back in to my 12-step fellowship. And that's basically what I did. I ended up landing in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, for the longest time, I had false belief systems. If you're new, if you're just coming back, You've got false belief systems that can kill you. This is why you need a good sponsor, an experienced sponsor, somebody with true working knowledge of the 12 steps. You need an experienced sponsor because of your belief systems. Here's one of my belief systems. I just need to not drink and not use no matter what. Because that's what I was hearing. Now, when you read the literature in Alcoholics Anonymous, when you read the Cocaine Anonymous literature, it makes it very, very clear that powerlessness is powerlessness. If you could just not drink and use no matter what, how are you going to admit to powerlessness? That's power to be able to do that. A symptom of being an addict is powerlessness, which means you're not in charge of when that stuff goes back in you. Until you've had a complete mental rearrangement through a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, you are powerless, and the time and the place is going to come and you're going to be lit up like a Christmas tree again. And that's what the first step says. That's what the first step says. Because powerlessness is powerless. If there's anything you can do to not use, you can't admit to powerlessness. Just do that. But how many times have we tried? How many times have we tried? How many times have you said, this time I really mean it, and then ended up being high again? How many times? So, a false belief system that I fell under after I started to realize I needed a power greater than myself was thinking that the meetings were that power. Thinking that the meetings were going to treat my alcoholism and my drug addiction. I really thought that meeting makers make it, don't they? You know, just, oh, if something really is giving you concern, just double up on your meetings, right? I mean, that's what I used to hear. Meetings do not treat addiction. Meetings do not treat alcoholism. The best that they can do is put us in the spiritual environment where we can get support from other people and start working our own recovery program. Because it's the recovery program, the 12 steps, that treat the addiction, not the meeting attendants. So I had a false belief system that I had to lose as far as meeting makers make it, because I saw a lot of meeting makers not making it, and that caused me some concern. So I had to dig a little bit deeper into this. Another false belief system that I had was, if I get a sponsor, if I do what the sponsor says, if I get a whole bunch of commitments, if I start saying yes, you know, to everything, I'll be okay. I think it's important to be active in a fellowship and in a home group. I think it's important to have a service ethic and figure out ways to be part of H&I and, you know, carry the message and sponsor other people. All of that stuff is very, very good. I think it's absolutely essential. But that in itself doesn't treat addiction. It doesn't treat alcoholism. The 12 steps do. You do those things as an act of gratitude after you've begun to recover from your addiction. Now, I'm talking 1990. In my area, there was no Cocaine Anonymous at that time. At least I there was a couple of NA meetings, and the stories that you people would come to AA and tell you were not real positive. And there was really a lack of big book or conservative 12-step recovery stuff going on. It was more about going to the meetings and sharing. It was more about, you know, getting commitments. It was a bastardized form of fellowship recovery. It really was. It was what had happened is between the 50s and the 90s, 12-step recovery had lost its way. It had lost its way. Very few real alcoholics or very few real drug addicts survived in the 50s through the 80s. They just didn't, because all you had was fellowship. You had a threefold illness, body, mind, spirit, and you had, instead of having a recovery process, you had meetings and you had commitments. So you had service and you had fellowship, but you didn't have recovery. So most of the people who were the real deals, the real powerless people, died from the 50s to the 80s. Because you don't see a lot of them around anymore. And I got to tell you, you know, I hate to be negative, I got to tell you, but I'll be in a meeting and somebody will raise their hand and say, I got 50 years sober today or something. I'll say, where the hell were you, you idiot? Where were you when I needed you? You know, why did you let the fellowship just completely abandon the 12-step recovery process? Why did you do that? So, you know, a lot of people really revere the people with a lot of time. I tend to resent them because they're part of the problem. Because in the early 90s, a bunch of us really had to start working to try to turn the fellowship back to something that actually works, which is the 12-step process. Another reason why I like Cocaine Anonymous. When Cocaine Anonymous was developed, it was developed with that in mind. The 12 steps are part of the whole deal. And that's not the way it is with a lot of fellowships. There are fellowships out there that really think you just come in and you share. I share. Well, if you can stay sober that way, believe me, you're not a drug addict. You're not an alcoholic. If you can stay sober that way, you're a heavy drug user or you're a heavy drinker. You're not powerless. You know, you can stop or moderate on your own because there's not enough power in something like that to keep me sober. I'll tell you that. What happened, luckily what happened with me was, I was a big music collector. I spent all my extra money on albums and stuff. And when I got sober, I started going to, I remember going into this one, it was like a New Age bookstore, and I saw recovery tapes. This was in New Hope, Pennsylvania. And they had recovery tapes, and they had Clancy's 4-tape set on the 12 steps, and they had some other things. And I go, oh, cool, you know, I'm in AA, I'm going to buy those. So I started buying these recovery tapes, and, you know, I was driving to work and listening to them. And because I'm a collector, what happened was I got some catalogs. And this is the key turning point in my life. I'm looking through the catalog and I see this name, Joe Hawk, Salvation Army Talks. And I say, wow, I wonder what it would be like for an American Indian to be talking about recovery. Now, Joe ended up becoming a very, very good friend of mine, by the way. But I ordered these in 1990. I ordered these Salvation Army tapes that were done in 1986 in Santa Monica, California. They were 12 one-hour tapes. And I started to listen to them. And it was honest to God, no fellowship, happy crap. It was all 12-step recovery. The mechanics of the steps. The actual practical application of steps. How do you do step two? How exactly do you do a resentment inventory? What is absolutely vital for you to do in the 10th and then the 11th step? It's ambiguous when you go to meetings. Because if you go to meetings and it's on the 11th step, somebody will raise their hand and say, I don't do this step formally. But I'm going to take this meeting hostage for 15 minutes sharing my opinion on a bunch of crap I know nothing about. You know, so you're not going to learn it in meetings. You're not going to learn it in meetings. So I start to listen to these tapes, and these tapes blow my mind, okay? They're talking a whole nother language. I'm listening to North Jersey recovery crap, and all of a sudden I find the holy grail. These sets of tapes, and they start to tell me what to do exactly. And I start to do that. And my sponsor's looking at me like I'm a wacko. I show up this one time with a 4-column resentment inventory. And I say, I got to do a fifth step with you. And he goes, where's your story? I mean, you know, it was a mess. There was nothing going on. But I actually took these tapes and started going through these tapes with an open big book and a pad and a pencil. And when it said to do something and Joe talked about doing something, I did it. And I started to recover. Not sobriety and recovery are two completely different things. If you just want to not use and that works for you, God bless you. But remember, I'm the guy waiting to buy the bottle behind the lady with the check? That's my problem. I'm okay after I get the bottle. Sobriety is my problem. You know, so somebody who's a heavy drug user and, you know, when they stop the drugs, everything is okay. That's fine. You don't need us. But when it's a deeper problem, when we have addiction, when we have drug dependence, when we have alcohol dependence or alcoholism, we need a bigger answer. And I found the answer in the 12 steps. It was hidden there in the book that they published in 1939 that no one bothered ever looking at. Now, all of a sudden, here I am. I'm truly recovered, and I don't even know it. I mean, I'm still going to meetings every night, you know, going to the fellowship meetings every night. And what I'm doing on the side here is kind of this like secret thing, you know, going through the steps, because you can't talk about it. You can't raise your hand in a meeting and say, "Oh yeah, you know, I was doing my fear, you know, columns the other day, and I self-reliance really has failed." You'd get slammed. You'd get slammed. Somebody would say, "I don't know what you're talking about, but you know, all you need to do is use faith, because faith is the opposite of fear." And you hear all this crap, you know. So you can't share this recovery stuff because you look like a lunatic. So you got to keep quiet about it. So slowly, you know, I've recovered from alcoholism. I've recovered from drug addiction, and I'm in these meetings, and I'm starting to share, and I've always been able to sound pretty good when I share, so you know, sometimes the tugboat with the most steam pulls the boats, and I started to sponsor a bunch of people, and the people that I was sponsoring, I wasn't, you know, giving them this big book stuff. I was, you know, they were drinking on me is what was happening, and they were picking up on me, and they were making me look bad, these guys. So in about 1994, I had bought a house in Potterson, New Jersey, and I can remember it like it was yesterday. In that early 1994, I brought somebody over to my house, and I opened the big book. And we started going through it word for word. And when there was an instruction, I did that. I did it with them. I mean, I didn't know any better. I thought that if you were taking somebody through the steps, you needed to do it all too. Because you can't ask somebody to do something if you're not willing to do it yourself. So I started sponsoring all these guys, and I started going through the steps every time I took them through the steps. You know, we would share. Now, I don't think that that's really the right way to do it, but I got to tell you, it worked. It worked unbelievable for me, because things started to happen in my life that I can't even describe today. I went from being a really, really bad electrician to accomplishing some extraordinary things in my life, and I certainly can't take credit for some of the things that I've done. I went from a bad electrician to right now I'm running a pharmaceutical plant, all the physical plant processes for a giant pharmaceutical manufacturing plant, and you know. You wouldn't have put me in charge of a lemonade stand in 1989, okay? Now, I was probably the number one media personality in the treatment world. I get to go all over the English-speaking world carrying the message in one way or another. I have literally thousands of friends and support group members. And today, the 12-step fellowship is everywhere. There's not a town with over 1,000 people in it where I can't go without hooking up with somebody. You know, it's like a big world. This recovery landscape is like a big world. I believe that because my initial problem was spiritual, and that spiritual malady was treated with a correct solution. And my job today is the maintenance of that spiritual condition. There are things I need to do, I need to be disciplined about, to continue to maintain that spiritual discipline. It's God's job to recover me. It's God's job to keep that obsession off me, that obsession to use or to drink. It's God's job. But it's my job to live a certain way, to live spiritually. You know, addiction is your problem. Spiritual living is your solution. And it just has to be applied in the right way. That's why you really need an experienced sponsor, somebody with working understanding of the steps. Now, because my problem was spiritual, emotional, and it was treated, what that did was that got rid of that fear. I'm not afraid to try outrageous things. I don't have fear of failure. I don't have fear of looking bad. I could care less what people think about me. Which I can't even tell you what a change that is. Because when I first walked into a 12-step fellowship room, everybody was looking at me and I was rendered mute. I couldn't say a word. You know, they might think I'm a jerk. Today, I could absolutely care less what anybody thinks about me. I am not attached to that drama in any way anymore, because there's freedom at the end of the 12 steps. There's freedom from bondage to self, that self-obsession, that self-awareness. You know, that self-absorption that we really suffer from. And that's what the booze and the drugs take us away from. To have that, I won't call it cured, but I'll call it removed. You know, that's the key to this whole thing. And then to stay close. I've seen a lot of people get recovered and then blow out the door. I'm free now. And get involved with jobs and not stay close to, you know, the fellowships where they found the answer. And that's not a great thing. I've sponsored a lot of alcoholics. I've sponsored a lot of drug addicts. And I can tell you this one thing. The people who are consistent with meetings, who go through the 12 steps and do them, you can put the word actually in front of every one of those steps. That's what we mean. Actually go back and pay the money back. Actually go back and make amends. Actually work with other alcoholics. Actually work with other addicts. Actually pray and meditate every single day as a discipline. The people that do that and then find some type of service ethic in their life and they stay consistent with it, every single one of them recovers. Every single one of them is able to stay away from mind-altering chemicals or liquids. I'm very, very grateful to be here. I think it's, I so support Cocaine Anonymous. Mark, thank you for asking me down here. I've got some friends here tonight that I haven't seen in a while, and that's cool. And that's all I have. We have like 8 or 10 minutes left. Anybody wants to raise their hand and share or whatever. Well, we got a little time left. Mark.
Sitting there and going to 90 and 90, those cliches that, you know, those things, those for me, false truths. The, you know, just don't drink and go to meetings, don't use and don't go to meetings. I couldn't figure out why I kept using. And you know, I was talking with my significant other this week about that, you know, and it's like the answer was presented to me, the spiritual teachers were presented to me in my life. Along the way, I was presented with people who were working the solution. My denial system and my ism and my power, my lack of powerlessness, you know, drove me away from that. And mainstream recovery today of what it is, of like, you just don't drink and go to meetings. And I wasn't getting as happy, and I was thinking like, what's the payoff for me, man? Like, I want to, like, there's got to be a payoff for me to stop. Like, I'm not going to stop unless I have some level of peace, some level of serenity. If I don't have that, why do it? And I can identify with what you said in regards to sobriety was my problem. That's what I meant. Because when I didn't have alcohol and crack cocaine in me, I wasn't okay. Everybody was looking at me, in a meeting or not. Everybody was judging me, in Wawa or here. And, you know, until I really got honest and started working steps, when the scorecards were at zero, when I had no other choice, you know, things started happening for me. Maybe not to my liking, to the degree of kindness and stuff like that, but I started having a sense of peace no matter what my circumstances were. Whether I didn't have a car to drive or I had a car to drive. I had a significant other in my life, I didn't have a significant other in my life. I had my kids in my life, I didn't have my kids. It didn't matter. It didn't matter because it was about me getting right with my Creator. Thanks for making the trip down here. If you could just mention a little bit, because I know I've been asked that, taking people through the work and you know, the recovered part versus what that means to you. I'd appreciate it. Because you see it in the book and
You know, there's a controversy out there today, cured and recovered. If you identify yourself as a recovered alcoholic, somebody will go, oh, you're cured, huh? Well, this may be semantics, but this is the way I would describe it. Let's say you have cancer, and you're cured of the cancer. Doctors would say the cancer has been removed. You don't have cancer anymore. However, if you recover from cancer, the symptoms of the cancer has been removed. The cancer is still there. That's the way it is with alcoholism, and that's the way it is with drug addiction. We never get all the way away from it. There's two ways you can die. You can die with your addiction, or you can die from it. You know, and we can definitely recover, body, mind, spirit. We can recover. And how it happens is that spiritual awakening. Now I'd say about 90% of the treatment professionals I've run into don't get it. About 10% do. But the mistake that they're making is they're trying to treat us with psychological and psychiatric interventions. Those are the wrong tools to use. Okay? We need to be treated spiritually. There's a lot of language in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which is I'm more familiar with than any of the Cocaine Anonymous literature. That's why I'm talking about it. But the language that they use in that book is a personality change at depth sufficient to recover. Attitudes and outlooks have changed. You'll know a new freedom and a new happiness. You've heard of these promises. You will have a spiritual awakening as the result of the 12 steps, a spiritual awakening, a shift in consciousness, a personality change. They even use biblical language, being born again. And when you understand what born again really meant, you know, 2,000 years ago, it means a whole different thing now. But 2,000 years ago, it means being born anew from the Spirit. And if we have a spiritual awakening, we no longer think and react the way we did prior to the spiritual awakening. Our feet are placed on different soil. We're wearing a different pair of glasses. And that's what recovery is. Recovery is very, very deep. Never make the mistake that just not using, if you're a drug addict or if you're an alcoholic, never make the mistake that just not using is and then everything's going to be all right. The issue is very, very deep within you. You have perspectives and perceptions and belief systems that need to be changed. And you're not going to be uncool after all this happens. You're not going to be the hole in the donut. You're not going to be like some lame brain, you know. You're actually going to have more power in your life. You're going to be able to do the things that you just talked about doing, you know, while you were doing lines or sitting at the bar. You'll actually be able to do them. So the spiritual awakening is about finding power. It's about finding freedom. And it's about a whole different way to look at the world. And that's really what recovery is. Sobriety is just, you can get sober by punching a cop. You know what I mean? This recovery stuff is a little bit harder. Yes?
Hey, sorry, I'm mad. I want to thank you so much. You brought me back. Because, you know, I fell a victim to that belief in my early sobriety. I'm in Brooklyn. I felt the belief that I was the one of those guys that needed to make meetings, and they said, put the plug in the jug and just keep coming. And I said, if I could put the plug in there, why would I need to come here? But thank God, this is how I found CA. Two guys came with big books into this clubhouse. The clubhouse was separated into two sections. It was the Mark's team and the Wilma's team. And it was, if you get sponsored by this guy or that guy, then you should just keep coming to meetings. And it was just a huge ego trip. And it's sad that it's around. There's places like that. But, you know, it played a part in my recovery that I needed to show up in that place. But, you know, it's amazing that as I go to different meetings and we read the promises and we hear constantly over and over. But, you know, a lot of times when you get in a meeting and you read all these readings, everybody's just like, okay, let's go through the motions. But the most important thing that I hear, and seems to be overlooked a lot, is that it's always been repeated that the 12-step recovery program works. And you know,
book died, and I'm really upset I was tricked. But then there was one guy, James or Charlie, who started talking about those 12 steps, and they said, shh, 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 you're going to scare the newcomer. You know, and thank God that I wanted to be scared, whatever it was. You know, and